I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Lawrence Holmes of 670 The Score in Chicago.
I'm Thomas George from SB Nation.
And I'm Mitch Albom from the Detroit Free Press, and welcome to this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this podcast every Monday and Friday. Yes, it's the podcast world's edition of the TV show that ran for so many years on ESPN on Sunday mornings. We've now moved it to Mondays and Fridays, which gives us an opportunity to wrap up weekends and set up weekends, which is good. Or, in the case of sports today, gives us a chance to look over everybody's old tweets, because apparently this is now becoming a new sport in America. What did someone say when they were 17 years old, and how can it trash their careers today? I don't think, Lawrence, I don't know how old you are, but I'm guessing that none of us had to deal with this in high school, because we weren't tweeting out things. They didn't have it. We all said dumb things in high school. We all used words like at least some of the words that are being thrown out there in the case of Trey Turner or Sean Newcomb or Josh Hader or many others. And yet now, because everything was recorded on Twitter and apparently nobody ever deleted any old tweets, there are people out there who just bring this stuff up. And now teams have to deal with an issue of, geez, we have a race problem here. Do we have a homophobic problem here? What do we have to do about it? How much punishment do we meter out for what somebody did in high school? Let's toss that out on the table and bat it around, because this is a problem for our time, guys.
I'm not sure if teams are ready for this, because what's happening is the doxing of these tweets, that people are actually going in and searching through some of these tweets to find stuff. I don't know if teams, the social media teams or the PR arms of these teams are ready for this, and they need to now try to get up to speed with it, or maybe try to get ahead of it in searching for their team members' social media accounts. And the thing is, one of their biggest problems is that teams do like to show the media accounts. Like, a lot of times on scoreboards now, you'll see, well, this is such and such Twitter or Instagram account. Mm-hmm. They need to do a more thorough vetting before they give that out to people, so that they don't have egg on their face when it backfires. And it eventually will, because a lot of young people thought that this was just a diary that no one was ever going to read. And yet now people are going back through them and reading them.
This is not going to be just confined to professional sports. First of all, every sports professional sports entity now has got to address this situation. And if they haven't done so already and had a high level discussion already, they're behind. They're in trouble. They need to, and if they don't, they better have one by noontime today, and figure out how we're going to deal with this. Whether the individual representatives of all their players, which if they're professional teams all have agents, they better get somebody in their little camp and their little and get somebody to go to become the person, the designated person to clean up the mess. Because they got if they have a mess to clean up, and then now we have to extend this to colleges. You think Nick Saban would like one of these things? I'm just picking that out of the sky, or Nick Alto, or John Calipari would like one of these things blown up in his face. One of his guys being finding out that they had said something offensive in a tweet as recently as last week. So this is a huge potential issue, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Bob, and I think the basis of it. The core of it, in part, comes to the fact that we've become a sort of retroactive community, not just in sports, but across the globe. And, the internet and digital media and social media are all a big part of that. You look at the Me Too movement, you're talking about some issues with some of the people that have come under fire mm-hmm. that happened to them in the 70s. And even the 60s, and the 80s. And if it can go back that far, if it can go back that far in those areas, it certainly can go back that far in sports to someone's high school years. And so I think the solution to it, though, is that you do what some of these guys have done, and you just step right forward and embrace it and say, hey, this is what I was thinking when I was a very, very young man and a very immature man. It doesn't represent who I am today.
Well, I mean, the larger question is should it? And how much does this matter? To pretend like this is something new is really to be disingenuous, especially athletes and the way athletes talk on high school teams. A lot of these tweets, and I try to go and read every one of them, because I find that these stories that we're writing, it's like offensive and racist tweets have resurfaced, but and nobody even reads them. You know, they just hear those two words, homophobic or racist, and they just assume that, that the person is a racist and the person is a homophobe. So I like to go back and read them within context, and in most cases you can. And they sound to me a lot like guys used to talk on teams when they were in high school, especially when they thought they were talking to one another. And when you're 17, and I'm not excusing bad words, and I'm not excusing anything. You know, we should all be smarter. But we also have to live in the world that we actually live in, of 17-year-olds trying to look tough, trying to talk tough, white kids trying to talk like rappers and quoting lyrics that they don't even understand. You know, I know people and have friends and nephews and watch kids grow up, and sometimes the things that come out of their mouth, you go, are you guys crazy? But they're trying on their adulthood, you know, they're trying bravado, and they end up saying a lot of stupid things. So I don't even want to repeat the words, because even repeating, you get accused of saying the word now. But we all know the F word for homosexual, the N word and racist, the H word for homosexual. These are a lot of the stuff that was going on. And when I'm looking at, for example, Sean Newcomb's tweets, where he had a call up press conference after he nearly pitched a no hitter. I mean, if you want to talk about like weird events in sports, this guy was within one strike of a no hitter. He talks about his no hitter with everybody and missing it. And an hour later, when these tweets surface, and that's another question: how do they surface? He has to let all the press come back in and talk to him again about stuff that he said when it was 6 or 7 years ago, when he thought he was talking to his teammates.
But Mitch, I throw
the question out to you. How much should it matter?
Well, I want to jump in right quickly on that, Mitch, and say to me, you know, youth is youth and bravado is bravado, but racist is racist. Mm-hmm. And when some of these, they're, you know, we can't group them all together. They don't all go together. Some of them are innocuous and some of them fit into the category of youth and bravado. But some of the things that have been said when we're talking about Hitler, Nazi-like ideas, and then some of the other racist, purely racist stuff, those are things that have to be accounted for. Those are things that have to be addressed.
And when you're talking about trying on adulthood means that there's consequences for your actions. And I do this. I teach a class in my alma mater, DePaul University. So I get 18 to 22-year-olds in my class. And one of the first things I have them do is I have them go through their social media accounts to see if there is anything in there that would prohibit them from getting hired somewhere. Because I talk with Career Builder, and now a lot of employers are, the 70% from the stats that I got, 70% of employers are friending or following people on social media to look at what their account is all about before they sit down with someone in an interview. So there are steps that you can take to do it. But I agree with Thomas that some of this stuff needs to be addressed. And the way that it ends up being addressed is, I appreciate if someone says, this is who I was 6 years ago, this is not who I am now. But I feel like it needs a further explanation. And that's where the consequence aspect comes in. I want to know, then what was it that changed you? I think those are legitimate questions. What was your journey to go from that immature 17-year-old to, you know, this 25-year-old man? And it's not just, I got older. It has to be related to the experiences that you've had that change you. And I personally, I want to know that part of the story. If there is going to be a press conference, those are the types of questions that need to be asked.
I think that that's fine for one person. I think you're going to end up having the same press conference and the same comments over and over and over again. Already, I'm looking at Trey Turner's comments. Quote, there are no excuses for my insensitive and offensive language on Twitter. I am sincerely sorry for those tweets and apologize wholeheartedly. I believe people who know me understand those regrettable actions do not reflect my values or who I am. This is pretty much the standard comment already. It's the same. Newcomb said the same thing. Hater said the same thing.
You're right. But then it becomes our job to follow up and go, how and why? And I thought that the guys in the press conference with Josh Hader did a really good job of trying to pin down what his feelings are and why they change. That's the next part of it. That's the responsibility aspect of this, is that you now need to, if we're supposed to just take it, take your word and say that this person is no longer like that, you need to explain why you're not like that. Why are you different from the person that tweeted out hateful language 8-10 years ago? Those things become important for explaining why consequence happens, like what things out there are important for us to learn about a player. And it goes back to, no matter how much we think we know a lot of these athletes, we have no idea who they are. And I think that when we put them up to a level of them being hero worshipped, that these are the types of things that can let people down. And there's still those who live in that world where there's hero worship going on.
When the hater thing surfaced a couple of weeks at the All-Star game, the first thing I did was say, where's he from? And I looked it up. And he's from a little town not too far west. It's just west of Annapolis. And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what forces, what was his background that would get him into that kind of a mindset at 17 to have that kind of a thought process. I don't know this town, but I mean, I think Annapolis is a reasonably urban circumstance. Yesterday, imagine my shock when in the course, I researched in the ninth inning. I'm sitting there in a restaurant with friends after watching the Red Sox play, and we're watching the ninth inning of the game. I said, "Oh, Sean Newcomb. I know the guy. I know the name, of course. Let's look him up. Oh my God, he's one of ours. He's from Middlebury, Massachusetts. Middlebury. He's born in Brockton, Massachusetts. Raised in Middleboro, which is I wouldn't call it's an adjoining community. It's Brockton. Really, I wouldn't call it a suburb per se, but a reasonably middle class, not a highfalutin community. It's not Wellesley. It's not Weston. It's reasonable. I mean, it's not a rich town at all, anyway, and he went to the University of Hartford. But anyway, I'm thinking, God, you know, to think that." He comes with this kind of mindset at 17, 18. He's hearing that from somebody, you know, what's happening in Middleborough, you know? And it just brings us all back to, as a white person, as a 70 septuagenarian white person, you're just trying to assess the world that you know versus the world that's out there. And of course, we now have a whole different political climate that we could never imagine 10 years ago. And you think, oh my God, there's still so much crap out there, there's so much bad stuff out there. It scares me, frankly.
I was just going to jump in, Bob, and say there, to me, that's a great reminder that this racism or this kind of thinking isn't limited to red state, blue state, or big town, small town. Oh,
we're the big blue state.
It just isn't. I mean, it can come from anywhere, from a variety of different places for a variety of different reasons. And I agree with Lawrence on the fact that just because we're getting these kind of mundane or sort of generic or modeled responses in terms of their explanations doesn't mean that as journalists we don't dig deeper or go further and ask questions. It's no different, in a sense, from the very bland answer you may get in reference to a question to a coach or to a player about an incident or a play or a game or whatever. That doesn't stop us from digging deeper to ask more questions and to get more to the root of the story. So I think the same journalistic rules apply there.
Okay, but what's the story? You know, what you're talking, Thomas, is the tenets of journalism, and we all live by them. But what is the story? Is it really our job to determine if every single human being who plays a sport harbors any racist or homophobic thoughts? That's a pretty tough task, and that's a lifetime of dedicating to try to figure out who someone is or who someone once was. Remember, we didn't have Twitter. And Bob, when you talk about being a septuagenarian, right, the thing that relates to that is that we didn't communicate with one another by pressing devices. We talked, and yeah. All the records of our conversations are gone. They're just in other people's memories. Oh, I remember, didn't you say that? But there's no proof of it. If every person that was on sports teams when I was a kid or a teenager who used the F word for homosexual, hey, man, was now being held accountable for that, they'd all lose their jobs. And I don't think half of them even knew what the word meant. Now, that doesn't excuse someone calling black people the N-word over and over and over again. But it also puts into context with rap music using that word constantly and kids, including white kids now in the suburbs, using rap music, and they call one another the N-word. Is that racism? Or is, you know, when they say, hey, N, you know, what's up? Is that automatically make a 17-year-old racist or just stupid? And if our job is now going to become vetting every single thing that a kid said when he was 17, I'm glad I'm not starting out in the sports writing business.
Our job.
I don't know how you stop at that.
Well, our job, in my opinion, is that the story, in identifying the story, is that the story is this exists. Let's dig a little deeper to find out why it exists. And then also by doing that, you provide enlightenment, which is a journalist, I think, you know, primary responsibility, enlightenment, because a week from now, when one of his teammates socks him in the nose and his eye socket is broken or whatever, and we go, well, where did this come from? Or why did this happen? Well, we could almost set the table for that, as good journalists do, say, hey, there's a problem, or this problem may exist even beyond when he was 17. In some instances, it may not. But to not follow through with the story and set the table for not only where he's been, but where he is and where he's going, that is really, to me, the crux of the story. Because a lot of times these things develop in a manner where we're chasing it on the back end when we could be out in front of it.
I don't know. It all sounds good when you say it, Thomas, but when you put it into reality, how much, you know, if one guy's 17-year-old tweets come out and 50 different reporters from around the country start writing the story, that's not perspective. That's not setting the table. That's setting somebody up for the rest of his life, or wherever he goes, he's now going to be called a racist. And we're responsible for that. Wherever he goes, he's now going to be called homophobic. The LGBT community is going to protest him. We're responsible for that.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily, Mitch, because it's all about what happens next. And that's where I agree with Thomas that we can't just abdicate our responsibility of here is the story. We're not saying that now every reporter who's covering a team needs to dox someone's Twitter account or Instagram account. But when the doxing does happen and the proof is brought to the forefront, it then becomes our responsibility to figure out. We love to write about body language and talk about culture in a locker room. These are things that can affect a lot of this stuff. So it's incumbent upon us to then ask follow-up questions on this to try and be responsible to the community at large when things like this. Why is this coming up? Why is it important? Why are these discussions important? And I honestly think that it can be used as a learning tool. And I just, you know what, as we were talking, I was flipping through Twitter and I just saw a tweet that just crossed from Cubs pitcher John Lester. And he said, if you're on Twitter, please spend 5 minutes it takes to scrub your account of anything you wouldn't want plastered next to your face on the front page of a newspaper. Better yet, don't say stupid things in the first place.
You know, I'm just as a reminder that there's always an antecedent. And there's the old biblical, there's nothing new under the sun. Anybody remember the name John Rocker?
Right.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so we've kind of been here before to a degree, right? And
except John Rocker said that stuff while he was an actual National League pitcher.
He was very much so.
And when John Rocker was playing, you never would have known what he said in high school because there was no Twitter account. And we cannot gloss over that. I don't mean to keep repeating it, but this is a whole different thing. Everything is now logged. And can I ask, I hate to be the Luddite here, but can you scrub your high school stuff and that nobody would find it? Or is there still a way for people who are really trained in this stuff to go in even if you erased all this?
If people are taking screenshots before you do it, and I would imagine that there are some people that are probably doing some of that stuff now. Yeah. But I think the larger point of the Lester tweet is, why not get to the root of why some of this stuff is said? And Mitch, it's some of the stuff that you've been talking about. How do we get to a point of having discussions about race and language and the use of language in 2018 America where you understand why some words are allowed in certain communities while they're not allowed in others. And I think that those are important conversations to have. But how do we not have them if we don't then get into and dig into why this stuff bothers people at some level? And that's whether it's Hader or in what he had to say or any other athlete, let's find out how the change happened, and maybe there's something valuable in there, or maybe the person hasn't changed. That's why asking these questions are important. And what Thomas was saying about locker room relationships and that culture, it could end up being a problem if those things aren't addressed. I know that I would be very uncomfortable being Josh Hader's teammate unless we had a long conversation about what type of person he is now versus the type of person he was when he was 17.
Well, they did jump to his defense immediately, which means, you know, but there's so many open questions. Things are going on in guys' minds. I'm sure they're saying, well, he seems okay, but I wonder what's really going on in his mind, you know? I mean, kind of thing. All right, fine. Can we not give them the benefit, either both of these guys? They both have issued what we would maybe call pro forma, explanations and denials. And this is not who I am. This is who I was when I was a callow youth and didn't know what I was talking about. Did you buy that? You know, and if they buy it, can we just move on? Is the sensitivity training going to prove anything? Is it going to be worth anything?
Well, that's a good question. That's how we should probably button this up. So, okay, we've talked about whether, you know, how much this stuff matters and how much you are who you were when you were 17. But what does baseball or football or basketball or hockey, what do they have to do in our minds here now? What steps do they actually have to take? Right now it seems that diversity training is the rehab of the moment. Do they need to do more? Should a player ever be suspended from his team because of something he said when he was in high school?
Excellent question.
I'm asking.
They do need to do more.
We're doing our repertorial duty, as Lawrence has pointed out. This is what we supposedly do. We ask these questions, and whether it's politics or sport or entertainment or whatever it is, we ask these questions, people will be asking these questions. And I'm interested to see how baseball. All right, here's another thing. All right, so far the two teams have been involved, but at what point does the commissioner's office try to get ahead of this in some way? Well, I think that's a very important question.
Yeah, you know, I think they do need to do more. They do need to make it at the forefront of the things they do and put the level of importance on it that it requires. And then you're always trying to not only deal with the situation that is at hand, but you're also trying to enhance the future. And the more you deal with these type of issues now and have these type of discussions now, the young people who are coming up and coming through, you're setting a standard and an expectation and an agenda and an environment that can be more conducive and more inclusive and be an improved one all the way around. So it's not just for the moment, it's also for the future.
I think one thing they're going to start doing is every kid who gets drafted to any team, the first thing that they're going to do when they get called in by the team is say, give us your Twitter account. We're going to give it to our IT guy. And we're wiping out everything that's ever been said by you up till this moment. And from this moment forward, these are the rules. And don't ever say anything that violates this or that. If you don't think that that's coming, you don't know professional sports.
I agree with you. And I think that there is a larger conversation here about social media. My mom told me a long time ago that not every thought needs to be shared.
Yeah. But you were probably growing up at a time where the only way that you could share it is speaking. But when everything now is, imagine if they had tape recorders that got put into some kind of forever computer file when we were kids. Would we never, all four of us, have never said anything that wouldn't have embarrassed us today?
You know, in the old days, it was don't mail that letter. Then it became get rid of that voicemail. Right. And now here's no, seriously, right?
Yeah, you're
get
right.
Rid of that, get rid of that message.
And don't leave the don't leave
ask
the voice, don't
Alec
send
Baldwin
the email.
Ask Alec Baldwin about message. You know, the old leaving
right.
a message.
Message machine. All right. Yeah.
And now it's this, and technology just is overwhelming us in so many ways.
I think Maybe we should just stop talking.
Yeah, well, I think we just need to challenge our young people in particular, and the teams, their young people in particular in sports, to just be more, to be smarter and to be more inclusive. And part of that is just embracing the situation for what it is. There was a time when NFL teams used to use reel-to-reel film on a projector and watch tape. Now we have, they have iPads and they have every kind of technology, and it's moved forward to an adjustment. And I think just the continued frank conversations about the real world they live in and the real responsibilities that come with that can produce smarter, more inclusive athletes.
Before we finish finally with baseball and then move on to football and who's on the hot seats in the NFL as camps are now open, any final thoughts on the Hall of Fame and the guys who got in yesterday and some of the ceremonies, you know, interesting names, both guys who waited a long time. And
I thought it was a very distinguished group. And the highlights, the idea of who showed up, Bruce Bochy moving heaven and earth to get there from the West Coast to be there with a guy he managed and with a guy that was a colleague in the coaching ranks, Alan Trammell, was very impressive. And, of course, the whole overview of Chipper Jones wondering whether his wife was going to deliver young Cooper was fun. But, I mean, I think it was very boilerplate in that regard, the appropriate gratitudes and thanks. They all seemed very happy and grateful. And then Vladdy delivering his in Spanish, which knowing that those of us who all remember Vladdy just basically didn't want to deal with English. A lot of guys jump into it and they become Joey Cora or Pedro Martinez or David Ortiz, and other guys say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to bother. And Vladdy did it his way, you know? So that's...
I thought I'd share, if you guys don't mind, I don't know if you saw it, the American Masters on Ted Williams. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
It's really good, and I didn't know that David Ortiz produced it.
Yeah, David's got his, he's quite entrepreneurial, Thomas, these days. You be prepared. Next thing you know, it'll be a Broadway show, the Impresario, David Ortiz. Who knows? Anything, I'm telling you, with him, anything is possible.
I just remember, you know, covering along with you, Mitch, of course, you know, Alan Trammell and Jack Morris, I've always was impressed with Jack Morris in particular and his fight and his tenacity. You know, he to me is one of those guys who is the true epitome of a tough pitcher. There's nothing that he backed away from. And you know, I remember Sparky Anderson always telling me that the one thing he loved about Jack was, you know, smart guy, and he's great arm and, you know, live fastball and all that stuff, but his location of his pitches and how he put all of that together with an idea and purpose and used location to his advantage was really great. And I just always admired his fight, and it's something that you don't see in today's game as prevalent, these pitchers who have that tenacity of a linebacker.
Well, his biggest tenacity was never to come out of a game.
Yep.
And that's what I loved about him, because you don't see that anymore now. Guys are looking up and saying, am I in the fifth inning? I'm almost done here. You know, I'm almost done with my work here as a starting pitcher. Let me just get through the fifth inning, and then someone else will take over. Morris never wanted to come out of a game. If he didn't go nine full innings, he felt he was a failure. And, of course, this was epitomized by the greatest game he ever pitched, where he went 10 innings in Game 7 of the World Series, and he told Tom Kelly, as Mike Lupica recounted for us last week, you know, don't even think about taking me out when nine innings were finished, and Kelly stuck with him. And he thanked Kelly in his speech yesterday. Thank you for leaving me in, you know. And I thought, I have to credit some other writer. I can't remember his name because I read so much stuff. But somebody put this theory out there, and I think it's correct, about whether Jack Morris deserved to be in the Hall of Fame or not. He's now got the highest ERA of any pitcher in the Hall of Fame, 3.9, almost 4 runs a game. And one of those whips or wars or whatever that doesn't make anybody happy. But, and this was put forth by this writer, and I echo it, the reason that he has to be in that Hall of Fame and belongs in the Hall of Fame is you cannot talk about the era in which he pitched without talking about him. Mm-hmm. You can't. He won two complete games in the 1984 World Series, and if Alan Trammell hadn't been the MVP, he might have. He pitched the greatest single game seven in World Series history in terms of pitching performance, 1-0, and wins there. He won 4 world championships with 3 different teams. And he was just dominant. You know, you talked about him when he pitched during that time. So even though his numbers don't pass some kind of computer test, the smell test of was Jack Morris a great Hall of Fame pitcher? Anyone who was living through that era probably already assumed he was already in the Hall of Fame.
We talked about this the other day. He is the flashpoint player of them all between the nerdy stat guys and the people who like to watch the games. And he is the flashpoint guy. The people, the sabermetrics guys hate him. They think we're fools for everything you just said. They'll just dismiss out of hand as irrelevant because they have numbers to say that, you know, he doesn't belong. I am with you, Mitch, 100% with Jack Morris, okay, on this regard. But he will forever be the flashpoint guy. That's just the way it is. And that's where we are now. We're in a world where people can become baseball experts who truly and utterly never have to watch a game because all they do, seriously, all they do is crunch the numbers, period. It's all about the numbers. This is Moneyball to the nth degree, even though Billy Beane himself will disavow, you know, 50% of what's in that book now. All right, my final thing on this, Jim told me, I must say, I'm a Boston guy, now obviously you know, but I'm the short list of my favorite players of my life. Jim Thome is right there, and my interactions with him were always incredibly pleasant, and I know of no naysayer. If anyone here knows Lawrence or Thomas or Mitch, have you ever heard anybody personally say a negative word about Jim Thome, the man, supposed to the guy who hit the 612 home runs? I want to hear about it because I don't know of any such person. This is
it's lore here in Chicago. He was here with the White Sox for 4 years. The owner of the White Sox, Jerry Reinsdorf, said that Jim Thome is one of the three greatest people that he's ever met. That's how beloved he is in the White Sox organization, and he's just one of those guys where when he would walk into the clubhouse, always had time for you, always had a story, was always pleasant. And I don't think that there's some guys you can see through the facade. Mm-hmm. I always felt like it was genuine with Jim Thome.
Well, that's my impression too, and I'm glad to hear you echo that.
Yeah. And last thought, and we'll move on to football. Alan Trammell, while being a fantastic shortstop and all the rest, also a guy you never heard anything bad about. Right. But the one thing that he did that you won't see anymore, like Jack Morris fighting to stay in the game, he negotiated his own contracts and did several of them while he was actually practicing. Like he did one with Bill LaJoy where he was out on the field and LaJoy came out and threw a number at him. What do you think? And he like took a grounder and he said, "Yeah, that'll do." And they shook hands and his contract was done. And I don't think we're seeing that anymore either,
Mitch, think about how many guys won't even talk about a contract that they're not negotiating during a season.
Yeah. I think anytime you can actually negotiate a contract with a glove on your hand, you're doing something that's going to last for a long time.
And by the way, it was very predictable and admirable that he would use his time to make the case for his double playmate, Lou Whitaker.
Okay, before we shift over to the NFL, let me tell everybody that today's show is brought to you by Simply Safe Home Security. If you've ever looked for a security system, you know that it's tough. A lot of systems are too expensive, they're too complicated, they've got long, terrible contracts. But Simply Safe is just awesome. Simply Safe is what home security should be. Everything you want and nothing you don't. It's great protection, it's ridiculously easy to use, and they've got a great price. Keeps your family and home safe 24/7. Simply Safe system is engineered to keep working during power outages, a downed Wi-Fi system, even if a burglar smashes your keypad. It's designed to stay out of your way. You won't notice it. It's really easy to use, and it just takes minutes to set up, and literally anyone can use it. With Simply Safe, there are also no contracts. It's 24/7 monitoring and only $14.99 a month. Simply Safe protects your home against intruders, but also fires, carbon monoxide, water damage, freezing pipes, any other things that might happen while you're away. CNET, PC Mag, Wirecutter all named it to their top pick for home security. So, order a Simply Safe security system today, and Simply Safe will also donate one to a family in need. Now, that says something about a company. You order a Simply Safe security system, and a family in need also gets a security system. But you have to go to Simply Safe, I'll spell it for you, SimpliSafe.com/sportsreporters. So they know where you heard it from. That's simplysafe.com/sportsreporters. simplysafe.com/sportsreporters, and take care of your home. All right, let's shift over to football. Now, camps have opened, and that means the preseason games are just around the corner. The season then itself just around the corner. And camp is significant for certain guys, maybe nobody more so than Andrew Luck of the Indianapolis Colts, because this is his first camp since 2016. He didn't play all of last year. He was injured in the offseason, and is he ever going to be the quarterback again? So it raises the question, is Andrew Luck, or if not him, who amongst the quarterbacks that are coming into the 2018 season is under the biggest microscope to perform? And we can begin with him and then and spread out to other guys. I do think that if you look at where he was drafted, how high he was drafted, who he was succeeding, you know, taking over for Peyton Manning and everything that was expected of him, Andrew Luck has certainly under-delivered for Indianapolis Colts fans. And now people wonder if physically he's ever going to be the same.
Well, one of the people, a lot of the people close to him would really argue that and say that he hasn't under-delivered at all, that he's been the victim of not having enough support, beginning with the offensive line and beginning with the leadership over there and the coaching, which just wasn't good enough. I think that, you know, when you talk to players who were around him when he first came through the door in his first minicamp, Adam Vinatieri told me that, you know, he was running things in his first day of practice there after just joining the team that veteran quarterbacks run. And he was like, he's not supposed to know that already. And yet he did. And I think his career is a reflection of him getting the maximum out of what he had around him up to this point, as opposed to him underachieving. It's going to be very interesting as he moves forward to see if they will now, with new leadership, continue to build more weapons around him. And I think that he is a can't-miss player to continue to do great things, depending on the health. It's all about the health, and no one can know if that shoulder is going to hold up or not. But if the shoulder holds up, I don't think we have any concern at all, or should have any concern at all, about Andrew Luck holding up his end of the bargain.
It's Mike, I got two things for him. Can he throw, and have the Colts done enough on the offensive line to protect him? Those are the two things I need to know, and we won't know that until probably October or November.
If I like what Thomas said, and I'm in that camp as well, and I'm going to throw this one out there. It's an unfulfilled potential, definitely, though, I think we have hope. I hope for his sake. He seems like a rootable guy that he gets to have the career that he deserves. I would say this: if in this coming draft, if in 2019 there is a young man with the overall credentials and qualifications of Andrew Luck coming out of Stanford, would he not be the number one pick in the draft? That the professionals still, he is what you fulfills a check mark of an intelligence and talent of what you would want in a quarterback. That still remains true. He's still a benchmark in that regard, I would submit.
Yeah. I agree with that, Bob. And I also say, having watched him and been around him through most of his career, you know, all of those ingredients and intangibles are so hard to come by. And yet he has them, plus a work ethic and a true sense of caring. I mean, Andrew Luck really wants to be great, and he wants the people around him to be great. And he's willing to pay the price to make both of those things happen. And so when you get the talent with the intelligence with the mindset, it really just boils down to the health, because all those other things are definitely there.
Yeah, but many a great quarterback has never become the great quarterback he could be because of health.
True.
And at this point in his career, health is as dominant as performance. You know, the shoulder, he had the kidney issue, he had the concussion, he isn't cruising through his career health-wise, and we'll see what happens. Remember, he started, he was 2012, right? So already, you know, we're 6 years into his career.
Yeah, and for a guy that's been beat up as much as he has, we might be at the halfway point for Andrew Luck at this point in his career. You brought up quarterbacks, Mitch. The guy that I'm most interested in now is Jimmy Garoppolo. because he had incredible success last year. His team goes 5-0 when he ends up taking over. He gets the massive deal. There's all the baggage of him leaving the Patriots and what that was about and whether that had to do with Bill Belichick wanting to find him a nice soft landing where he could be successful and get paid. And now you find out that there's a lot of personality behind Jimmy Garoppolo, and how people react to that personality is going to be fascinating, along with how well he plays. And I think that there is potential for the Niners to take a little bit of a jump this year if he plays as well and as steady as he played at the end of last year.
Well, aren't we in Jimmy Garoppolo, doesn't he absolutely personify the short attention span of today's modern sports fan and the what have you done for me lately being the way that we judge everybody? He had a career as a backup and then goes to San Francisco and how many games was it? 4, 5, 6, something like that. And basically, based off of that, everyone has deemed him as the steal of the year, and he personally is going to lift the San Francisco 49ers back to Joe Montanaville. And that's a lot to put on someone who had just a good half stretch of a season, not even a full half stretch of a season. Are we making too much of a handful of games in terms of our expectations when now you start a whole season, everybody knows you're there, it's no surprises anymore, they've got
tape
to look at. Yeah, there's tape. And he is on the San Francisco 49ers. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's not on the New England Patriots. And they are not a great team. They got a lot of holes. Thomas, is he capable of really lifting them to the playoffs?
Well, you're dead right about that, Mitch, because he's in that vortex, that whole sphere of the quarterback is the savior and the quarterback is the hope. And anytime you do anything that any franchise and fan base can latch onto as the savior for the present and the future, they jump, they leap toward that. And it certainly has happened with him. But again, he's going to be as good as the people around him. And you know, without protection and without weapons, it's going to be an uphill battle. Now, I know Kyle Shanahan knows offense and knows it well. And I love the kid McKinnon that they got from the Vikings, who is going to be a feature player with them. I think he may develop into Garoppolo's best friend, because that's, you know, every quarterback needs a really, really good guy to check down to who can make things happen. And this kid in the open field can really make things happen. We should all look for him to be sort of a surprise elite player this year, because he's going to get a lot of opportunities to save Jimmy Garoppolo on some of the breakdown plays, you know. And then as we move forward, we'll see how well they can protect him to be able to do anything downfield that matters.
Right. I'm going to throw out another candidate of a different type. I mean, same position. Eli.
Oh, yeah.
I think Eli's in a very intriguing spot this year. The Giants passed up an opportunity to go for one of the number of quarterbacks, the young quarterbacks they could have taken. And of course, not knocking who they took, but that's a whole other. But the combination, therefore, Eli and does Eli, because he did not play well last year, period. No, only the staunchest Eli defender or family member could maintain that he had a good year. He's 37, and is it over, or can he bounce back, or will the very presence of Barkley, if he is as good as people think, change the whole dynamic of the way the Giants play offense, and will a healthy Beckham make all the difference? But I still think Eli would be a guy. I think there's going to be a lot of eyes.
I'm with you on that, Bob. I mean, he's one of the guys, and really, because of the attention of the quarterback and the importance of the quarterback, you could almost make a case for each of the 32 teams with each of their quarterbacks. There's some issue. There's some thought. There's some doubt. You know, there's some hope. You know, and it just goes on and on, and it makes that position what it is. But I think of Eli. I think of Russell Wilson trying to do more with less. You know, I think of Patrick Mahomes being thrown into the fire now, basically, as a leader of the Chiefs. And Blake Bortles, can he do more after getting them to the AFC Championship game and can do more offensively? Joe Flacco, everybody's looking at Joe Flacco thinking that it's just a matter of time before he loses his job, and he's out to prove otherwise. And Ryan Tannehill in Miami is coming back from injury, being paid a lot of money and having a lot of responsibility on him, but has never done it. Kirk Cousins, of course, is, you know, he's supposed to be that missing piece in Minnesota, but it really is he? But the number one guy for me is the number one paid guy, and that's Matt Ryan. You know, Matt Ryan, you know, players in this league, they look and think talent, wisdom, intellect, all of those kinds of things, but they also look money, cash, dollars. They're all sort of competing against each other in terms of their salaries, and they know what the other guy makes. And when you're the number one paid player in the league, as Matt Ryan recently became, and you have that type of cachet in turn, along with cash, literally from the franchise, you really have got the spotlight on you, not only locally and not only in your locker room, but across the league. And how is Matt Ryan going to respond to this, having taken his team to the Super Bowl, falling short, coming back last year, and now being the highest paid player in the league? Does that equate into Super Bowl championship?
Well, first of all the guys you mentioned, you're right about. And secondly, you realize, you know, you can almost mention pretty much every quarterback. You can even mention Baker Mayfield with the lowly Cleveland Browns. That's an interesting guy to look at and see, you know, how much scrutiny he's going to be under, how much can he turn around their fortunes along with their other draft picks.
And whether or not Tyrod Taylor should be that team's quarterback.
Right.
So if they think they can win something.
But I want to return to Eli because he and one other quarterback, and I'm surprised I'm listening to everybody talking, nobody's mentioned him. To me, these two are in some weird ways mirrors of one another, and that is Eli Manning and Ben Roethlisberger. Mm-hmm. Now, both of these guys have won Super Bowls more than you think, you know, sometimes. And yet in between their Super Bowls, they sometimes have games where you go, honest to God, why is this guy still playing? You know, and you say that sometimes about Eli Manning. Eli Manning not living in New York, and I think East Coast people, and particularly New York people, have a particular view of Eli Manning because, you know, there's all the history that goes on and all the sturm and drang that goes with him in the papers there. And then there's people out in the hinterlands like me who just look at Eli Manning's performance, and I don't hear all the other stuff that goes at. And sometimes I watch him and I go, God, he's terrible. You know, what an awful decision that was. And yet, he's a Super Bowl twice winning quarterback, and you can't deny that. Ben Roethlisberger, to me, often plays games where he just doesn't use his head. He turns the ball over ridiculously, and yet he's got tremendous success. Now in Pittsburgh, they're asking, has he, like they are in, for Eli Manning, has he stayed too long at the fair? Should he really still be playing? He, at the end of each season, it now seems he goes through this metaphysical, meditational type of, who am I? What am I? Do I still belong in the NFL? He puts out some kind of cryptic message that this could be it. But then he's always back. He's not giving up the job. And I see him and Mike Tomlin and their sort of success with one another really on the precipice up there in Pittsburgh. And they could either go to a Super Bowl. It's perceivable, even though Le'Veon Bell will be bitching about it the whole way. I want to get off this team and get some money. Or they could have a precipitous fall with him and you know, maybe be lucky to make the playoffs. So to me, he's like a fast microscope story.
It's funny you mentioned Ben. To me, we all have, as fans, the fan in us has a visceral reaction to people, and I'm scared of him. I don't like, as a fan of the Patriots, when I put the fan hat on, and they played, they always seem to me, they're always playing the Steelers every, I still respect him. I expect big things from Big Ben. That's just me. I'm blind to these faults. I only see the good stuff in my mind's eye. So it's just funny the way it is.
I think they're both really driven guys. I mean, and they both know that there's more to be done. I don't know if there's ever been a quarterback who in a year span has resurrected like Eli. I mean, they had him benched for Geno Smith pretty much and run foot out the door. I mean, he was moving on. Yeah. I mean, you're done. And, you know, we're going to, you know, draft a quarterback and go. And he somehow is able to turn that upside down where the general manager and head coach are fired. And he's the starting quarterback for 2018. It is a Lazarus act among NFL quarterbacks, unlike anything we've ever seen. But I do think he knows what to do with it, particularly with more around him. And we keep coming back to that because it really is key. I think the offensive line will be better. This running back, Barkley, is very special. You know, if Beckham stays healthy and with some new ideas from Pat Shurmur, you know, Eli has the mental makeup to understand where he is and what needs to be done, particularly given what has happened. And I think he's going to look at this as a second lease on his career and really be ready. I think we're going to see maybe some of the best of him that we've ever seen this year. And I kind of tend to agree with you, Bob, and the same with Ben. I think he's primed to have a pretty big season. Will it be enough for the whole dynamics of all the other things that are going on in Pittsburgh is the question.
The thing ultimately with Eli, maybe this year, is very simple. His link for it is going to be linked with that of Beckham. And if Beckham is back at 100% and is able to do what he does, and Barkley too. I mean, the way they're talking about Barkley, you know, I mean, I saw him in college. We all did. But my God, the pros, they're slobbering about him. I mean, look at this, what they're paying. So Giants intrigue me. You know, I'm no question. I want to see how this shakes out.
I think it could work out really well. I think it could work out really well with Saquon Barkley. I don't know if he'll have like a LaDainian Tomlinson type season catching the ball, but I think that he could very easily have a season like Priest Holmes or Matt Forte out of the backfield and being a dual threat guy.
Totally agree.
And am I the
that,
only
Lodge?
One who wants to say thank you to the Minnesota Vikings for shaking up the quarterback world so much that it gives us so many interesting storylines? They almost go to the Super Bowl last year within a whisker of it. Then they get rid of all their quarterbacks and they bring in Kirk Cousins, who is now going to be not only, you know, on the firing line as a starter for real. He had some of that in Washington, but now he is the guy for whom they gave up, you know, the cast of quarterbacks that they had. And as a result of Kirk Cousins getting that job, Case Keenum, who wasn't even a starting quarterback before 2017, now gets $18 million a year to quarterback the Denver Broncos, who may be a really good team. And, you know, if Case Keenum is Case Keenum of last year and not all the seasons before that, you got to talk about the Denver Broncos as a potential Super Bowl team. And that's fascinating to me because both of these teams who are contenders for the big game have new quarterbacks taking over. And generally, that doesn't work. You know, it usually takes at least a season for everybody to get used to playing with one another. But Case Keenum in Denver and Kirk Cousins in Minnesota, if they are successful, are on Team Thomas. Now, you keep talking about what's around them. Denver's got a lot of stuff, especially defensively, around the Case Keenum. And Minnesota's a very complete team if Kirk Cousins turns out to be a quarterback. So these are cases where two new guys might end up taking their teams very far. I stunned you all, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, we just, you know, up every quarterback. There's none left.
Let's just say my final thought for this occasion on the NFL is that more than any other league, it seems to me that somebody comes out of nowhere frequently. Maybe not every single year, but frequently. Who's the three? I'm not posing this question. This is not the quiz. I'm just saying, rhetorically speaking, gentlemen, who's the 3-13, 4-12 team that's going to be in the playoffs? Because pretty much so, there is one. Which is one of the things that makes the regular season NFL, for me, rather fascinating.
I see the Broncos using Case Keenum a lot like the Vikings did, in the sense that they're going to really ride their defense and hope he can do enough to make a difference. And you put Chubb with Von Miller, that's a heck of a start to have a defense that really dictates things and getting back to some of the formula that they had when they won the Super Bowl with Peyton Manning basically sort of like guiding the ship. And I think that's the formula they want for Case Keenum, but I do think he's capable of more. But it's very interesting to me that the things that they look for and like in Case Keenum, the Vikings didn't think was enough. And we continue to see in the NFL when it comes to quarterbacks, one team's trash truly is another team's treasure. That everybody looks at things and they do not see the same thing across the board. And that's never more prevalent than at quarterback.
Thomas, I thought that your point, too, about all the quarterbacks, I had never really thought about it. But when you said it, you're right. Like, there's a story everywhere. And it used to be that you could just say, all right, well, we know that Brady and Breeze and Manning and Roethlisberger are going to have their teams there. And now they're you're wondering, what are the succession plans in New England? What is it in New Orleans right now? Peyton Manning's already gone from the game. What's going to happen with the quarterback situation in Tampa Bay this year? Because they've got a problem there, both on the field and off the field, with their guy. Can Cam Newton take another step in his development? Does Josh Rosen ascend out in Arizona? Is Russell Wilson's contract the reason why the defense in Seattle had to get rid of all of its players? Like, there is a lot. And, like, really thinking about it in that context has kind of got me fired up for the NFL season.
Well, that's why the NFL is so popular. And this is the thing that baseball just is jealous of and can't find its own version of. There is one star that everybody knows on every single team, basically, you know, with the exception of maybe a couple that aren't really on the map, and it's the quarterback. And in each quarterback is so marketed and so well known and so presented and analyzed from the draft day forward that everybody kind of knows at least one player on every team because they know about the quarterback. And you didn't even mention Aaron Rodgers,
right?
Who is, you know,
coming off of injury.
And yet everyone's wondering, is the window closing on him? So when you have a league where your star players still have intrigue, your biggest stars, there's still question marks about them, and everybody wants to know, you have fan interest. And that's why, you know, you can hear the rumbling across the country a month before the NFL season starts. Now, the last of which things, and we can close with this because it ties in well, is Tom Brady, who ended his first press conference since, I guess, May or whatever, very abruptly when he was asked about Alex Guerrero and Edelman's involvement with him or whatever. And I don't know, you know, Bob, you live there.
Yeah.
I don't know how big a shadow this is or whatever, but whenever guys walk away from press conferences and say, that's it, I'm done, my ears always perk up. Like, okay, why is that such a sensitive topic? And is there more there than we're thinking? What light can you shed on that?
I'll simply tell you that it didn't shock anybody here that he did that for that particular question, because he is sensitive to the topic of Alex Guerrero. Alex Guerrero is a sensitive topic for him. It's a sensitive topic for Bill Belichick, and that's the way it's going to be. And all that meant the other day told me is that, hey, once again, for the umpteenth time, I'm so glad I do not have as a job to cover the New England Patriots on a daily basis. It is a difficult assignment. It's not as pleasurable as it should be, given the nature of the quality of the football that they play. And I think it's going to be a potentially difficult year. Brady's going to be sullen. He's going to be evasive. He's going to be monosyllabic. He's not going to be a source of any good copy this year. And that question, that topic is all. It was a fair question. It was not an unfair question. It was a fair question asked by Van Volen about because it's out there. Everyone was, that's an immediate assumption. People wondered when Edelman got suspended as to, he's also in the umbrella of Guerrero. We wondered about substances. Tom laughed. He could have laughed it off. He could have handled it in a better way. No, that he got so uptight about it tells you how sensitive a topic it is.
You know, the Patriots guys have been such a insular within the shell franchise for so long and have had so much success. And people around the league certainly envy them, but also wonder when and how does it crack? Because it will. That's their feeling. There is no dynasty, and there's no team in this league from the 49ers great years to any others that you can mention where it didn't come to an end. And so they've been waiting a long time for this thing to crack and come to an end, and the question has always been when. And I think we have to really wonder if this year is going to be different for them and if they start to move in that direction. You lose a Super Bowl in the most draining of fashions, and then you come back and you have these issues from Malcolm Butler to Guerrero to Brady and other teammates clearly not being happy with Belichick over the Butler situation and other things that have happened, and you know, Edelman gone, and so it's just this situation where they've been waiting, they've been looking, they've been watching across this league for this team. for the cracks that usually happen with them when things like this happen to finally take effect. And I really am looking to see, will this be the year where the toll of all of those things does creep into the play, does creep into the product, and does creep into the winning?
The dynamics are very different this year already. There was an unusual offseason. Not just the Butler thing hung over, number one. The Butler thing still hangs over, number two. It does, and it will continue to do so, particularly if the backfield doesn't perform better this year. The defection of a Nate Solder to Giants to become the highest paid, at least temporarily, I think he's already been overpaid, not overpaid, but outstripped by somebody. Nate Solder, the defection of Deion Lewis, who was a very important part of their offense, the defection with Danny Amendola, who also exits by using the word fun, now he can have some fun. Yes, it's different, and I'm not surprised that the league is not only, but as you say, anticipating, but desperately hoping for their demise, and will relish in their demise. Don't we all know that?
That's why the NFL reminds me of Game of Thrones. You know, there's a House Stark and House this, and there's House New England and House Minnesota and House all these. And that's why the NFL loves it. There's soap opera stuff that you can talk about in the off season that carries into this season. And will this be the time that the Patriots crack? And will the Eagles be for real? And will Minnesota regret the day when they swept out their quarterbacks? It's high drama. And and played once a week, just on Sundays, just like when Game of Thrones is shown. I think I'm starting to see a connection. Plus, there's a lot of violence in both of them.
Well, Bob's right, though. I mean, you look at what Gronk talking about possibly retiring, and it seems like there is a clear rift. Like, a lot of people were angry when the story surfaced last year about New England, but there seems to be a clear rift between Brady and Belichick, and some of it may have to do with what went down with Garoppolo, or maybe they're just tired of each other. There is some thought on that the shelf life for a lot of these relationships is a decade. And considering that we're talking closer to two decades with Brady and Belichick, maybe people are just at the point where they've tired of looking at each other's face.
Tom's messing things up, I mean, by being so good because I guarantee that Belichick had it all thought out. The Garoppolo was the successor. They were going to have their hope for version of Montana to Young or Favre to Rodgers, and he was going to have it. He was going to congratulate himself for getting it done, and then Tom's messed everything up. I'm only mildly facetious here. Only mildly.
Yeah. On the other hand, if that Hail Mary pass to the end zone somehow gets caught in the end of the Super Bowl and the Patriots score a 2-point conversion and somehow win the Super Bowl, none of this is happening. I mean, this all we gotta recognize this all stems from losing a close Super Bowl that they felt that they were entitled to win, and that's what changes everything. And on we go. All right, well. Guys, no parting shots this podcast because there's too many of us. It would be too onerous to put on. We're already close to an hour, over an hour on this. So, listener, you get a break from the parting shots from all four of us. We'll resume with those on Friday. But Lawrence and Thomas, great to have you guys here. Thanks so much for joining us, and come back and see us anytime.
Really thank
good.
You.
Thank you.
Good job, guys.
All right. And on behalf of Bob and Lawrence, Thomas, and everybody, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a terrific week.